I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and our friends at the Teamsters Local 695. John Nichols from the Capital Times actually reporting from Washington today. Obviously, this special election in Wisconsin, the 10th Senate District, Republicans recruited a good candidate. There was a spirited primary, but really it wasn't divisive. Adam Jarko as a young rising star for the Republicans. But the Democrats won by 10 points in a district that Mitt Romney and Donald Trump easily won. What say you, John Nichols?
This is, I would argue, one of the biggest election upsets in Wisconsin in a very long time. Now, we've had surprises before. There's no question of that. But even the most optimistic Democrat thought this was a stretch. Now, the Democrats recruited a fine candidate in Patty Shachner for this seat. She had roots in the district. She was active politically, but also somebody well-known as a medical examiner, a school board member. I mean, she's sort of like, in many senses, a perfect candidate.
Mm-hmm. She's in St. Croix County.
Mm-hmm. Right. In the district, this western Wisconsin district that parallels the Mississippi River and then goes into some rural counties. It has a suburban component coming out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, but those folks often kind of vote or think Minnesota. They're not as connected in. So really in this district, you're still looking at a core of voters who are old school Wisconsinites, some in those, growing regions right along the river, but also out in rural counties that stretch deep into the state. And so this is essentially a rural Republican gerrymandered district. Democrats nominated a good candidate. Republicans had an outstanding candidate, a guy who was very well regarded, not just by Republicans, but even some Democrats. And so what you basically got was a clean test of where we are at right now. The Republicans put more money in, but the Democrats were viable. By any reasonable measure, it probably should have been about a 60-40 Republican win. The last time
this is a tough race to do because the media is so expensive. If you were to go on television or radio, right?
You got to go into the Minneapolis, St. Paul market,
right?
But also, if you're smart, you go local radio, local mm-hmm. newspapers, and I think a lot of that was done. But here's where it gets interesting. The Democratic candidate up there, as I said, outstanding pick. She identified herself as both a progressive, but also somebody who was in touch with the turf. And, her biography noted her involvement with the Wisconsin Bear Hunters Association or group. It also...
Well, now, wait a minute, John. John, isn't Therese Brousseau involved in that organization?
I'm not sure how many members of the Madison delegation are active with the Bear Hunters. But also identified her as a grandmother and, painted a picture of her as somebody who, is maybe not your typical Democratic recruit, but she didn't run from Democratic values and ideals. She was strong on public education. She was strong on public services, strong on health care. And here's the interesting thing. She ripped on the Foxconn deal. She talked about, why isn't economic development coming to western Wisconsin? Why is it, why is it going to multinational corporations, distant places, distant money, stuff like that?
Yeah, and, you're talking about the $4.5 billion now?
Yeah, I know. It's getting up there.
Although, let me just interject this, though. This is interesting. Adam Jarko actually voted against that deal. He was one of the few Republicans who did, and it still didn't save him.
Well, but he was part of a caucus that made that deal possible, right? And, you know, this is the dynamic of politics today. The Foxconn deal is an extension of Scott Walker and the Republican Party.
Who?
Mr. Walker.
Scott Walker. You have to
I know.
Have to pronounce it properly. Scott Walker.
And boy, I'll tell you, Scott Walker has got a problem with this thing. I think it's quite fascinating because this race illustrates that if you nominate a good candidate, if you run, you know, very critical of the Foxconn deal and also the way Walker's run the state, and, of course, if you surf the anti-Trump sentiment, which turns Democrats out and frankly, causes at least some Republican-leaning voters to stay home, you can win, not just squeak by, but you can win by 9-10 points. And you understand, in Britain, Sly, when they have a flip or a swing in a district, right, they talk about, they add up the percentage that the current winner takes the race by and the percentage that the previous person on the other party won by. If you do that in this district, you end up with a 35% shift from Republicans to Democrats.
Well, I don't want to
get 35% shift.
Let me add this, and I don't. That's an amazing shift. Former Representative Smith actually posted the county by county numbers. Obviously, Shatner easily won Pierce County, won Dunn County, her home county, St. Croix County, but she almost beat Adam Jarko in his home county in Polk County.
Well, and see, remember, Polk was a traditionally democratically leaning county.
Years ago it was, so yeah.
It's not shocking that you can work your way into some of that turf, but it's when you put it all together and you add up, you get a 35% shift from Republican to Democrat in a district that the Democrats haven't held for a better part of 20 years, in a district that Donald Trump won by a 55-38 margin, 17 points.
Here's the thing, though. Everybody's saying, you know, the governor is tweeting out a whole bunch of things, wake up call, wake up call. I don't think the Republicans were asleep in this race. I think they worked very hard.
They knew they had a problem.
Which raises the question, what do they do?
Well, this is the thing. They knew they had a problem. They poured money into the district. They had a money advantage with an attractive candidate, and they were not, nobody snuck up on them. They thought they were seeing off a real challenge. They didn't necessarily expect to lose, but they were serious about it. So here's the interesting thing. Scott Walker, who is a smart politician, not a smart governor, he doesn't govern well, but he is smart politically. He recognized there was no way to deny what happened out there. I mean, there's no way to spin this thing. And so he flips over to what I would argue was a fundraising appeal. And that's Scott Walker, you know, just lives on money politically. And so wake up call, wake up call, wake up call. That's essentially pleading for money. But what's interesting is, how did he plead for money this time? How did he try to position on this thing? Did you notice that almost everything he referenced was liberal, right? People don't know that we're working hard for public education and stuff like that.
Public education.
I know. This is a guy who cut schools, who attacked teachers and their unions, who used resentment to try and dial down and, frankly, did severe damage to public education in Wisconsin. Now he's trying to, in the immediate aftermath of this, to do what I think we all saw he's going to attempt to do this year, to run as a moderate, as somebody who is, you know, not some traditional conservative. Now, he's lying, okay? This is dishonest politically. But
that's such a harsh word.
But that's the answer to your question of what they're going to do. I think they're going to try as hard as they can to lie to the people of Wisconsin after years of presenting themselves not just as conservatives, but as a national conservative success story, right? To say this, Wisconsin's leading in the lurch to the right. Now it looks like Walker and potentially his legislative allies are going to try and run a fantasy campaign, a false construct campaign, because they know that it's not just Donald Trump who's a problem. It's not just Trumpism that's a problem. Conservatism is now being seen in a much more difficult and uncomfortable light than it was just a couple of years ago.
I'm going to make a prediction here today. Okay? If the Democrats pick a halfway decent candidate, I think that, the likes of Howard Markline, they're done.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're seeing here, because in this district, you're right that Jarko was smart enough to see that Foxconn is an incredibly dangerous issue, the issue that will defeat Governor Walker in the fall. He was smart enough to run a moderate, kind of locally oriented campaign, and yet he got whipped. He got beaten pretty badly.
We knew by 9:30.
Yeah, and look, again, a 35% swing. You have a 35% swing. I don't care how gerrymandered your district is. That's going to make it a lot harder for Republicans. If you have half that swing, somebody like Markline's in real trouble. But here's where it gets interesting, Sly. I think what we're starting to see is something you'll understand. I think many of your listeners will. This is the Lincoln Chafee effect. Lincoln Chafee, the senator from Rhode Island, a Republican senator, had broke with the Republicans on major issues, war and peace, economics, education. He was a liberal Republican. And people in Rhode Island knew that. They liked Chafee's father. They liked Chafee. But when you got to that critical election, I believe in 2006, Chafee's on the ballot, running for reelection, saying, I'm not with George Bush. I'm a much more moderate guy. I'm an independent liberal Republican. And the people of Rhode Island just said, yeah, we do like you, but we just can't put up with this anymore. You're voting to put the Republican right-wing extremists in charge of the U.S. Senate, and that's just not acceptable.
Well, this is kind of how these swings work now. I never got the feeling that in 2010 the people of Wisconsin disliked Russ Feingold. They sent a message to Barack Obama. He paid a price. Wisconsin voters threw him out because they were unhappy with the way Democrats were ruling, and they were pumped up. And I bet you the people that voted yesterday, and of course we're recording this the day after the election, I bet you more women came out to vote yesterday than men.
I'm quite sure you're right. I'm quite sure more, Democratic-leaning voters came out. And special elections are unique, right? They do have a different dynamic. But a 35% swing, that's not, that's not subtle. That's a big message. And remember, Sly, this special election in Wisconsin is the 34th flip of a legislative district since Donald Trump became president. What we're seeing here is a real swing at a level that is very measurable. And final thing to note, we almost had a even more shocking swing over in Washington County.
Yes,
there's a seat there that was up for grabs. And in one of the most, arguably the most Republican county in the state, or one of them, the Democratic candidate got 43% of the vote.
Right, where normally they get between 25 and 30.
That's right. And so here you have a situation where, in very, very Republican areas, Democratic candidates are getting wins and incredible traction. And what that translates to is not a suggestion that Democrats are going to win everything. They're not. But, again, going to that British model where they measure the whole of a swing, what you say is, if you can achieve a swing that big, then you start to look at every district, right? And you say, okay, let's say our measure is going to be half of that. Let's say it's going to be, 17-point swing. How many state assembly and Senate districts in Wisconsin, if you have a 17-18-point swing, how many Republican districts, safe Republican districts, suddenly come into play?
Well,
I can promise you there's a lot of Democrats right now in Madison around the state who are looking down those lists in the blue book.
You know, it's interesting. This is when a lot of people decide they're going to retire.
Yep. A, Republicans retire, but B, this is when you start to talk about those swings. This is when the Democrats call the president of the local school board, call the local mayor, call the chairman of the county board and say, you know, we've been asking you to run for a long time. Now, this is the year. If you're ever going to make a run in a year where we can tell you that A, you got a good chance of winning, and B, there will be the resources, because imagine how good this is going to be for Democratic fundraising. I mean, you're going to see Republicans scared and Democratic recruitment start to take off.
All right.
Precisely the time they need it.
All right, Fisher cut bait here. You ready? Here's a question.
Yep.
I'm going to put you right on the spot. Will Paul Ryan run for re-election in 2018?
Nice question, because you know, everybody was jumping on this thing last night, including Randy Price, who, you know, I think he, I'm not sure what exactly he tweeted, it's something like, we are coming. you know, and Bryce was on TV last night. He was on CNN. This is Randy Price, Ryan, one of Ryan's challengers, one of the two Democrats running that primary. He was on national TV last night, and he was bringing up the Wisconsin legislative win with Don Lemon, and Don Lemon didn't know about it. And you could tell he was sort of like, wow, that's really interesting. And here's the bottom line. I think Paul Ryan will run. I think that he wants to continue in Congress. I think it would be devastating if he chose not to run, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally for the Republicans. He holds together a very, very unstable caucus. And so I suspect he will run and do one more cycle on it. And I suspect that he could lose. I mean, it's going to be a real race, but he will run. And instead of him flying all over the country, my suspicion is he'll spend a lot of time at home in the first district trying to save his seat.
I'll buy him a roadmap. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us at SliceOffice.com. Coming up next, we'll talk about the craziness in Washington.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic is a multifaceted shop offering guitars, amplifiers, and all accessories, guitar lessons for all ages, and instrument repair of the highest quality. Take the scenic drive to beautiful Fort Atkinson and see what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call Jeff's Guitar Clinic today at 920-723-1733. That's Jeff's Guitar Clinic at 920-723-1733. Jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us. You know, over the years, there are a lot of people that have lost their dignity in politics, but one of them who's always remained dignified and credible is the congressman from Atlanta, John Lewis. Here's John Lewis the other day.
Do you think President Trump is a racist?
I think he is a racist.
How do you explain it and what do we do about it?
We have to stand up, we have to speak up, and not try to sweep it under the rug.
And what does that mean? I've heard that many of you in the Congress this week, Democrats in Congress, are going to try to bring forward a motion to censure the president.
Well, I tell you, as a member of the House, when that resolution come up, I will be one of the people to speak up and speak out. I think we should do it. We must do it. We must educate our children and generation yet unborn.
Do you think there are Trump supporters and Republicans have any idea how profoundly that a lot of Americans are literally hurting because of what the president is doing, and actually people around the world?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think
they
just think this is a game?
They don't understand.
Do you think that they think this is a game?
Yeah, they do, clearly. You see two Republican senators who said initially that they didn't know what the president said or didn't hear anything, and then now are saying the president didn't
say. Oh, I've got those clips in just a moment.
But the reason I bring that up is, you don't play those kinds of games if you're taking something seriously. If you think it's a serious matter, you know, even the most crass politician says, "Oh, we gotta kind of do the surgery here. We gotta go to the heart of the matter." They're not. They're playing games. They're literally debating whether the end of that word is hole or house, right? The key word in that the president said, rather than acknowledging that no matter, you know, whether it was hole or house, it was still the S word attached to other countries and the people who come from those countries. And so here's the critical thing. It's summed up by Scott Walker. We have an editorial in the Cap Times, I believe, today, that points out that Scott Walker's response to this thing was to say it was the president's remarks, in which he clearly expressed a racist attitude toward immigration, not wanting people from countries that are predominantly black and brown, wanting people from a country that is predominantly white. When the president said that, Paul Ryan's response was to say, that's unhelpful. Sly, unhelpful is when you don't clean your dishes right in the sink. Unhelpful.
I'm actually, by the way, pretty good at that, being unhelpful.
Well, I give you credit. I'm sure you're one of the more unhelpful people I can imagine. Unhelpful is when, you know, you're with a bunch of people in a car and you get to a gas station and you don't volunteer to throw in for gas, right? Unhelpful is, you know, when you don't salt your sidewalk, right? It's a good thing to do all those things. But the fact of the matter is, when the president expresses racist thinking as regards immigration, and frankly, in a way that affects our foreign policy and our domestic policy, and you're right, that hurts a lot of people, but also that signals that our policies might extend from that racism.
Well, a lot of people just try
to... Speaker of the House and you don't respond to that?
Yeah, it's...
With anything but the word unhelpful? You're not taking it seriously.
You know, a lot of people just try to characterize this as partisan politics, but Congresswoman Mia Love from Salt Lake City is one of the more conservative members of Congress. Here's what she had to say.
Well, Jake, I can't defend the indefensible. You have to understand that there are countries that do struggle out there, but they're people. Their people are good people, and they're part of us. We're Americans. You have to understand that my parents, they came from Haiti. They worked hard. They paid their taxes. When they pledged their allegiance to the American flag and became U.S. citizens, they meant every word of it. And they did everything they could to take on not just the benefits, but the responsibilities of what it meant to be an American citizen. And you have to understand, I'm a product of that. I am the American dream. That's who we are. Those are not just American values, but they're certainly Utah values. And they're values that we all hold dear. So it was really difficult to hear, especially because my parents were such big supporters of the president. And I think that we have to do everything we can to make sure that we are coming from a place of compassion and we're speaking from a place of kindness. I mean, that is the at least minimal standard here.
It's pretty profound.
Perfect. And frankly, two things I'd observe on that. Number one, I wonder if Mia Love might be thinking she signed up for the wrong party. And number two, just imagine if Scott Walker or if Mitch McConnell had said that, right? I think it would have had a profound impact. I think that President Trump would have been chastened. Now, maybe Trump would have decided to yell at them or to pick at them, but I think there's a decent chance that if some prominent Republicans like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, some of the other governors, and or Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, had come forward and said precisely what Mia Love said, obviously with variations because her family actually is from Haiti, but it had spoken in those kinds of terms, I think Trump would have gotten the message. As it is right now, I don't think Trump has gotten any message whatsoever. And I think that the Republican Party is, by and large, you know, identifying itself with, despite the example of a Mia Love or even a Lindsey Graham asking some questions, is by and large identifying itself with Trump's approach here, not maybe with his words, not saying that, but with an attitude toward immigration that is clearly racialized.
You know, let's take a look at the state.
Clearly cruel.
Let's take a look at the state of Georgia, where their senior senator, Johnny Isaacson, immediately condemned the president. The other senator, the junior senator, David Perdue, whose father, Sonny Perdue, former governor, is in the Trump cabinet. Here's what David Perdue decided to do.
Get more on that, but just to be clear, I'm not clear on exactly what you're saying happened in this meeting. You say it was a gross misrepresentation. Senator Durbin has been very clear. Senator Graham has told others that the reports were basically accurate. Are you saying the president did not use the word that has been so widely reported?
I'm telling you he did not use that word, George, and I'm telling you it's a gross misrepresentation. How many times do you want me to say that? What is happening here is the same thing that happened in 2013 where you had a press secretary of your president who said it didn't happen. What did happen in that meeting was a very constructive conversation about how to move forward. We were listening to a proposal that the Democrats are bringing forward. It's not a serious proposal, but $1.8 billion has already been basically approved. It's in the current budget. What we want to do is get serious about a compromise. Look, this deal has got to find symmetry. And so far, the potential is there. We can solve the DACA. We may even be able to solve some of the Dreamer numbers that Senator Durbin wants to talk about. But we have to talk about ending chain migration and securing our borders, George.
You're sounding,
it's no more complicated than that.
You're sounding more optimistic than the president this morning. He just put out that tweet saying DACA is probably dead.
Well, unless the Democrats get serious about negotiating, I mean, what we have to do is...
There is a deal.
That really was absolutely an awful, awful moment. You know, if you look at the chain of what has happened in this situation, he's clearly lying through his teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's also pretty excited that he could pull out a big word like symmetry. You could tell, you know, he's like, you always like when they sort of pause when they say it. Like, did you hear me? But whatever the hell he means by symmetry in this situation.
By the way, he's a loathsome individual who made a lot of money outsourcing jobs.
Yeah, he's an awful person. But beyond that, he and Tom Cotton, you know, have clearly chosen to go with the president on this one, to defend the president. And that's more egregious even than Paul Ryan.
Well, but the White House didn't deny this the day it happened.
Well,
the president went and called around Capitol Hill bragging that he did
it. Might be good for him.
I actually think the president is surprised that these two were willing to go out there and do this. And now, in fact, the president is saying he didn't use the word. But the word really isn't the issue. It's the policy. I mean,
exactly. The word, by the way, and this shows how immature, frankly, most of our media is and incompetent. CNN, other places, they got so excited to use this S word on television. They were like, he said this, he said that, you know, he kept S word. They were so excited about that they diminished and in some ways missed the real story here. If the president had not said the word that he did, and whether he said S house or S hole, irrelevant. But if he had not said the word that he did, you're right, this might not have gotten as much attention, but it should have. Because the president of the United States, by all accounts, or at least by all the credible accounts, clearly indicated when he was talking about Haiti, El Salvador, African countries, that he didn't want people from those places. Why are we getting people from these asshole or asshouse countries, right? And then in a parallel conversation, he's going, why can't we get more people from Norway? I mean, that's not complicated. You put those pieces together, and what you see is a resurgence of an old and awful attitude toward immigration that historically said, we want people from certain countries but not from other places because of what those people from the other places look like, because of the religions they practice, because of the circumstances that draw them to the United States. And remember, who were the people in the past who somehow got on the other country, on the unwelcome country list? It was Italians, Irish, Eastern Europeans, Middle Easterners, Asians. Now we're talking Africans, people from Latin America, people from the Caribbean. Fine. It's the whole world.
You know, I heard former Senator Rick Santorum saying that in this policy, we really can't allow people without degrees to come into this country, that we have a different economic system now. We don't need people that make things coming into this country. You know, I find that offensive.
Well, it's quite an acknowledgement, isn't it? Right?
Right.
That, you know, because that's not a message for immigration. That's a message for people working on the line at factories across this country, that the trajectory forward, the vision that these people are entertaining is not one that expects to have much manufacturing. Now, if that's the case, Sly, maybe you're a 55-year-old man or woman on the line at a factory, and maybe you can see it out. But what you've just been told is it's not just immigrants that aren't going to be welcome. Your kid doesn't have much of a future because America isn't looking for people that make things. That's, you know, this is the thing. I hate how Congress and the media tends to discuss immigration because they rarely ask the next question or go the next step. Because if you do ask the next question and go the next step, what you recognize is that our attitudes toward immigration relate very, very closely to our attitudes toward the future of the economy, towards the future development of the country. And if the United States is saying, we don't have room for immigrants, we don't want immigrants, we don't want anybody who is going to come to this country and seek to build something or kind of work their way up. We only want people who've got money and degrees and all these things like that. They're also saying that they think the future for American-born folks, for multi-generational Americans, is not as open or as expansive.
That is,
as filled with opportunity.
That is a great observation and a great place to leave it. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day in mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.